Chris put a lot of pressure on me in the first service, so I was hoping he wouldn't say it again. But when he said that about, you know, he never lets anybody else come up here on his stage, that puts a whole lot of pressure on me because I'm fixing to blow it for a whole lot of guys that follow after me, I guess. Or maybe I'll set the bar really low and they'll have a chance to win. I lived a pretty charmed life for most of my life. Grew up in a great family, godly family, no divorces, very few deaths. The only people who died in my family were grandparents as they got older, you know, the kind of things you kind of expect, you anticipate as they get to the end of their life. So things were good. By the time I reached 2004, I had been a student minister. I had been a coach of a state championship football team, assistant coach. I can't take all the credit. I'd been to seminary. I was married to a beautiful lady. I had three incredible kids, and I was planting a church down in southeast Georgia, Douglas, Georgia at the time. And then 2004 came, and things changed drastically. And I want to show you a little video that kind of sets the story I'm going to share with you today.
Looking back on the memory of the dance we shared beneath the stars above. For a moment, all the world was right. How could I have known that you'd ever say goodbye? And now it all would end the way it all would go. Our lives are better left to chance. I could have missed the pain, but I'd have had to miss the dance. Holding you, I held everything for a moment. Wasn't I the king? But if I'd only known how the king would fall, hey, who's to say? You know I might have changed it all. Missed the pain, but I'd have had to miss the dance. It's my life, it's better left to chance. I could have missed the pain, but I'd have had to miss the dance.
It was a beautiful spring day. In fact, it was Good Friday, the Friday before Easter. And I was awakened by the sound of my oldest son, Harrison, screaming in that middle bench seat of our minivan. He was screaming, "Daddy, Daddy, what's wrong? What's happening? Is this a dream? What's happening to Mommy?" I turned to face my wife. I'd been sitting in the passenger seat for the last part of the trip. Looked at her as she rolled her head back against the headrest on her seat. And she let out this huge deep sigh like she was in a lot of pain. I would later discover was actually the last breath my wife would ever take. There was a stranger who was standing in the window that had broken out as the vehicle had rolled over. And he was trying to talk to my wife. She wasn't responding. And he saw that I had come too. And he said, "Sir, is there anything I can do for you?" And I said, "Please, I just need you to take care of my wife. I think I'm okay." He disappeared from the window, so I began to talk to my kids, trying to figure out what was going on, even trying to put together the pieces in my own head. I said, "Harrison, are you all right?" He said, "Yeah, Daddy, I think I'm okay." He was still continuing to ask about his mom. Abby, my daughter, was seated immediately behind me in the seat, and I couldn't turn around to face her because the vehicle had crunched in on my legs. The seatbelt had locked into place. I had a broken right wrist, a broken left shoulder. So I said, "Harrison, how's your sister? Is she okay?" He said, "I don't know, Daddy. She's not moving." Of course, my greatest fear was that something tragic had happened to her, so I began to cry out, "Abby, Abby, it's Daddy. Answer me. Daddy's talking to you. Answer me." To the point where it became a command and seemed like forever before finally she said, "Daddy, I think I'm okay." The stranger had made his way around the front of our vehicle and had now appeared in my window where it had broken out as well. We had been hit by three guys in a Ford Explorer going 55 miles an hour when they ran a stop sign. Flipped our vehicle over and spun it around about three or four times, and it came to rest in a ditch along the side of the South Georgia Highway we were traveling on. He stuck his head in. He said, "Sir, is there anything I can do for you?" And I said, "Please, I just need you to take care of my wife. I think I'm going to be okay." He said, "Sir, I don't think your wife's going to make it." In the midst of those conversations, I had struggled enough to kind of get loose enough where I could see the left end of that seat. And it was then for the first time that I realized Josh wasn't even in the vehicle with us anymore. In the rolling over the vehicle, his seatbelt had actually snapped, and he had been thrown 50 feet away to the edge of the woods along the side of the highway. So I turned back to the stranger and began to plead with him. I said, "Sir, there's a third child. You got to go find him. There's a third child." He disappeared. He and the other strangers that would come up on the accident eventually found Josh laying face down, still in his car seat. He rolled him over. He knew infant CPR, so he revived my son right there at the scene of the accident. The ambulances came. They got me out of the vehicle, and they put me on a backboard, put a neck brace, slid me in the back of the ambulance. In a few minutes, the EMT jumped in next to me. He said, "Mr. Barron, we found your son. He's got a pretty bad head injury, but we think he's going to be okay. But what I need you to do is I need you to talk to him as we ride to the hospital. You need to do what you can to keep him comfortable." So they slid him in. He was on the other side of the ambulance. I couldn't reach out and touch him, couldn't hold him because obviously being strapped down. So all I could do was just say, "Josh, Daddy's here with you. It's going to be okay. It's going to be all right." And so for 5 or 10 minutes, that's all we did all the way to the hospital. They got us to the hospital and separated the family into different rooms to begin to determine the nature of our injuries. It wasn't long before I heard the curtain pull back on my part of the ER, and in walked our pediatrician. She was a very dear family friend and a member of the church I was pastoring at the time. She walked in and she stood right at the edge of the bed so that I could look up with that neck brace on, look up and see her in the eyes, and I could tell she had been crying a great deal. She said, "Ridley, I'm here. You tell me what you need, I'll do it." I said, "Stephanie, I just want to go know what's going on with my family. Nobody's telling me anything." She said, "Well, Ridley, Sarah didn't make it through the accident." I said, "Well, tell me what's going on with the kids." She said, "Harrison's going to be okay, but he was not unconscious in the accident. So we want to keep him here with you tonight at the hospital just to observe him." Said Abby had some seatbelt bruising. She's got some cuts from the glass flying around in the vehicle. We think she's going to be okay, so we're probably going to dismiss her in a little bit and let her go home with your sister. My sister lived there in the town, and so she would go home and spend the night with her aunt, her cousins. She got to Josh, and she hesitated just a little bit. She said, "Josh has a much more severe head injury, Ridley. We think he's going to be okay. We think we can take care of him here at the local hospital, but with your permission, what I'd like to do is to fly him over to Savannah where he'd be at a larger hospital where he's going to get much better care." I said, "Absolutely, Stephanie." I said, "Whatever you think, I trust you. Just do whatever you got to do." So they did a life flight from there to Savannah, which was about 3 hours away. My sister, who had been on her own spring break trip with her family, came in, immediately found out about the accident, drove to the hospital, checked on the three of us who were there, and then she packed her bags and she drove to Savannah, Georgia to be at his bedside all through the weekend so that there was a familiar face. Every time he would come to, he would see somebody he'd recognize, and she was the one that took many of the pictures you just saw here in the show. Stayed in the hospital Friday night. On Saturday morning, I asked them when we got, all of us woke up, I asked them to bring Harrison and Abby to me so that I could be the one to let them know that their mother had died and she wouldn't be coming home with us. They dismissed us about lunchtime on Saturday. We went home to a house full of family and friends and church members who had gathered. Several of my church leaders came over to the house and said, hey, we just want to pray with you, just want to be here for you, make ourselves available. One of them was, one of the leaders was my personal physician, a friend of mine. He gave me some medicine to help me sleep through the week. And as they got ready to leave, they said, hey, you do remember, I hate to talk business, but you do remember tomorrow's Easter Sunday. Wanted to know who you wanted to get to preach church for you tomorrow. And I said, I will. And he said, are you sure? And I thought to myself, no, I'm not, but yes. I said, yeah. I said, guys, my church family's hurting as bad as I am. I know how much they love me and our family and have loved on us for the last 4 years. They need to hear from me. So I got up Easter Sunday morning and delivered the message at our service that day. On Sunday night, my sister swapped places with a family friend who had babysat for our children numerous times. And once again, there was a familiar face at Josh's bedside all through the weekend. And she came home. And the reason for that was on Monday morning, we got ready to do a memorial service for my wife. We were in the process of moving back up here to Middle Tennessee to start a new church, so we were going to go ahead and fly her body here for her burial. Monday morning, we did that memorial service, and it was Tuesday morning before I personally could go see Josh face-to-face. Between Easter services, injuries that doctors wouldn't let me travel with, arrangements that had to be made for my wife's transport, just all those kinds of things. So throughout the weekend, I had gotten reports from both my sister and my friend. Just let me know every time a doctor or a nurse would leave the room, this is what they're saying, this is where his situation is. Tuesday morning, my sister and brother-in-law drove me over because doctors wouldn't let me drive myself. Got to the hospital, and I went up to the PQ unit there. I took a white phone off the wall and said, my name is Mr. Barron. I'm here to see my son Josh, and these doors swung open. I walked down through a hallway, went to the first room on the right, and was greeted by the scene you just saw. And I'll be honest with you, it was a very unsettling scene. Very uncomfortable for me, not because it was a hospital. I'm a pastor. I'm in and out of hospitals all the time, but because it was my kid. And it's something totally different when it's your kid. My 17-month-old was like most 17-month-olds. He was into everything he could get into, and you were constantly chasing him all over the house. He was a live wire. But that day I walked into that room, he was almost deathly still. And there were all these tubes and wires connected to him. I didn't know what to say, didn't know what to do. My sister came over to me. She said, Ridley, it's okay. You can just go talk to him. So I walked over, and as I got closer, I could hear that he was making this constant moaning noise of discomfort and pain over and over and over again. He had his right hand down by his side, so I leaned over, and I put my index finger down into his hand, and I leaned over close to his ear. I said, Josh, it's okay. Daddy's here. And he rolled his head over and he looked at me, and my sister burst into tears. She said, it's the first time he's responded to anybody's voice all weekend long, Ridley. We hung out there for a little while. The nurse gave me the opportunity, as you saw in the pictures, just to hold him for a little bit, which was a really sweet time. Then we went to lunch with a family friend who was a pastor there in town who kind of helped us, encouraged us, prayed for us. Came back to the a hospital that afternoon and had a chance to talk with the doctor in charge of his care over the phone. He was not able to be at the hospital, so we talked, and I told him, I said, listen, basically the biggest thing for me is just knowing whether or not he's going to be able to be okay, and in 2 days we're traveling up to Middle Tennessee. We're flying up there with his mother. Is there any chance at all that he could go and be a part of that trip? And the doctor honestly said, you know, we don't know with a 17-month-old. We just never know with their injuries. But, yeah, based on the reports and the scans we're seeing, we feel like he might be able to travel. So we went home Tuesday night, got up Wednesday morning. My sister came and got me again so that we could go take care of some errands. I had some doctor's appointments to follow up with my own injuries. Had to go to the funeral home, stuff like that. Went to the pharmacy, and as we're coming out of the pharmacy, my sister's cell phone rang. I could tell from her end of the conversation that it was our friend who was still at Josh's bedside and that something wasn't right, because she was making statements like, why did they ask you to leave? Why aren't they telling you anything? Are they not going to let you back in? Before she could hang up the phone, though, and I could ask her what was going on, my cell phone rang. And I picked it up, and I said, my name's Ridley Barron, and the voice at the other end said, Mr. Barron, I just need to know if there's any way you could come back to the hospital. I said, can you tell me what's going on? She said, no, sir, I can't. I said, you can't tell me anything because I'm like 3 hours away, and if this is a conversation we have over the phone, that would be cool, but if I need to come, I'll come. And she said, no, sir, I can't tell you anything. I said, you can't tell me anything at all? She said, no, HIPAA regulations prohibit it. And I laughed, and I said, ma'am, HIPAA regulations, you know who I am. You called me. It's not a mystery. And she got aggravated and hung up on me. So I called back to the number they had given me the day before during my visit and gave them a patient number, and I said, can I speak to the head nurse on the floor, please? She came to the phone, and I said, ma'am, I just got this really strange phone call from one of your nurses, and she didn't give me a whole lot of information, and I just need to know what the situation is. And she said, well, Mr. Barron, if you can, I need you to drop everything that you're doing, and you and your family need to get here as quickly and safely as possible. So we did. My sister and my brother-in-law dropped what they were doing and made the trip back over to Savannah with me. We had planned on going anyway, but the trip just got bumped up a little sooner. Got over there and went up to the PQ unit. I took the phone off the walls I'd done the day before. I said, this is Mr. Barron. I'm here to see my son, Josh. And this time the doors stayed closed. And they stayed closed for a really, really long time. We were standing in the hallway trying to guess as to what was going on and why we had been called back. Finally, the doors opened up, and before I could get into the hallway with my family, we were met by a group of doctors and hospital administrators who were walking towards us, and the doctor who was kind of leading the group said, Mr. Barron, could you and your family meet us across the hallway in this conference room? So we walked over, we sat down. That same doctor spoke up and said, Mr. Barron, there has been a horrible, horrible mistake. And I don't remember anything else about that conversation that day. I completely shut down. He finished sharing what he had to share, whatever it was, and then one of the other guys said, hey, is there anything at all we can do for you? And I said the only thing a daddy knows to say at that point. I said, can I just see my son? So we went back into the room where we had been the day before, and on Wednesday I was greeted by a completely different scene. As I walked in the doorway there on the other side of the bed from where we were standing, there was a group of doctors and nurses who were kind of in a huddle talking to each other. And as I walked into the room, they looked up at me as if they had been caught doing something wrong. On the other side of the bed was a lady I'd never seen before, standing right up against the edge of Josh's bed, and there was a sheet that was draped over his chest. I stopped. I stood there for a second. The vice president of the hospital came over next to me. He said, Mr. Barron, we need to know what you want us to do. And I turned and I looked at him. I said, what do you mean what I want you to do? I still don't have a clue what's going on here. He said, well, Mr. Barron, your son's head injury has caused him to have seizures over the weekend numerous times. And every time he's had one of those seizures, we've administered a medication known as phenytoin. And every time we've done that, he's responded favorably and has been okay. This morning, your son had one of those seizures, and we called down to the pharmacy downstairs, and our pharmacist made a mistake and sent up an adult dosage, which is 5 times the strength that's required for a child his size. He said, normally, we can induce vomiting, we can suction the stomach. There's different things that we can try to do to take care of those kind of medication errors. But he said, this particular medication is like super glue to the veins. When it hit your son's heart this morning, it stopped. I said, can you tell me what that lady's doing to my son? He said, that lady is a pediatric cardiologist, and right now she has her hands inside your son's chest massaging his heart to keep him alive. She's been doing it for the last 2.5 hours so you can get here. I said, so you're telling me if she stops, he's going to die? He nodded his head. He said, yeah, Mr. Barron, in all likelihood, if she stops, your son will stop living. So I said, well, then you need to let him go. The lady stepped back from the bed. She took a towel off the edge of the bed. She wiped my son's blood off of her hands. She said, "Mr. Barron, he's still here for a few more seconds if you want to talk to him." So I went back over to the edge of the bed where I had been the day before. I leaned down and told my son goodbye. I told him to go be with his mom. We left the hospital that day, made the 3-hour journey back home, and in those 3 hours, we turned our conversation to a whole lot of questions, a whole lot of issues. And one of those questions was, how do you deal with a hospital that's let you down? You trust your family member to them. How do you respond to that? My brother-in-law is a lawyer, and he actually specializes in medical malpractice. And he said, "Listen, Ridley," he said, "I'll be glad to walk this journey with you. It's going to be a difficult one. I will advise you. I'll stay out of it. Just you tell me what you want." And I said, "Well, Keith, there's two things I want you to tell the hospital." He said, "All right." He said, "I've got a phone call set up with them tomorrow. You just tell me what you want to do, and I'll let them know." I said, "Well, first of all, it's very important to me that you let them know, or that you let them tell the pharmacist that I forgive her." I said, "It's extremely important that she hears that from me, because she very well may have been the one who kept my son alive for those first 4 days. And I don't want her to have any regret or think that I have any bitterness towards her." He said, "All right, we'll do that." I said, "Secondly, I want you to tell the administration of that hospital that because of who I am, because of my personal faith and the way I was raised, that I do not intend on suing them to get rich off of their mistake." Once again, they were people who were trying to do the right thing, and it was just an honest mistake. And while I think there's some things that they need to do for me and to help me out with what's going on, I'm not going to sue them. He said, "Okay." So I went back home, and because of a broken shoulder, I had to sleep in a recliner for the next 8 months of my life. They wouldn't let me sleep in my bed. My shoulder wouldn't heal like it was supposed to. And that recliner literally became a crucible for my faith. It's where I went through the struggle that I was going to have to go through, that I still go through. I had to put into practice something that I had actually taught my teenagers as a student ministry for all the years I was in student ministry, that you feel free at all times to question God, because he's big enough to handle your questions. Just be ready to hear the answers. Be willing to listen to what he's going to say. And so I did. I questioned everything I'd ever been taught. I questioned everything I'd ever believed, every Sunday school answer I'd ever been given. I questioned my beliefs about death and hell and heaven and everything else that God had said about himself in his book. I questioned whether or not he could even be considered good or righteous, because as I tried to search through the word myself, I kept coming across these passages about how God will never sleep and he'll never slumber and he'll watch over you and he'll take care of you. And my question to him was, "Were you asleep on April the 9th when I was coming home? Because something doesn't seem right about this." Where were you when I needed you? Those are tough questions for me to hear coming out of my own voice. I'm a pastor. Even one night, I got so frustrated. I said, "For crying out loud, I work for you, and this is the way I get treated." That went on for months. Well, in the midst of that, we got invited to go back over to Savannah to sit down and talk to the lawyers, those necessary conversations you have to have. Went into this really nice lawyer's office, and the conversation went something like this that day. "Your son probably would have died anyway. And if he had lived, he would have been nothing more than a vegetable. And because he was a vegetable, he would have never gotten an education. And because he never got an education, he would have never held down a very good job. And therefore, he wouldn't have provided much of an income. So his life isn't worth very much monetarily." And that's how it went pretty much the whole day. And somewhere about just after lunchtime, I got so mad at hearing them say that same kind of stuff to me, I slammed my hand down the table and looked at the guy and said, "You're going to start running up that kind of total, you're going to lose. Because my son's life, my son's smile was worth $1 million to me every time he walked in the room. And the way I see it, you've already cheated me out of about 2.5 months of smiles." And didn't faze him. He kept on. "But your son would have been a vegetable. You have to understand, blah, blah, blah." I finally looked at my brother-in-law who was sitting there. I said, "You remember all that crap about me being a Christian, not suing them? Forget it. You go after them with everything you got." And my brother-in-law, being very wise, said, "It's probably time for us to go home." So we did. Late July, just a few weeks before we made the move back to Middle Tennessee, I was in my recliner, and I remember the night just like it was yesterday. I was looking out the back window of our house that looked onto a field there in the rural area we lived in. It was moon was a full moon. It was beautiful. It was bright. It was almost like daylight. And I was having one of those debates with God. And I was crying out loud. Everybody else had gone to sleep. My kids and my mom, who had moved in with us just to help take care of the kids until I could get healed. And I remember screaming at God and screaming at God. And finally I said, you know what, God? I don't like this. I don't think it's right. It's not the way I would have planned it. But I still believe you're God. I believe you're still on your throne. And though this isn't the way I would do this, I'm going to make a deal with you. If you promise to walk with me through this journey, I will do everything I can to bring good from my son's death. Be very careful what you negotiate with God. We made the move to Middle Tennessee, and my sister and my brother-in-law moved their whole family and their entire law practice up here to be close to me to help raise my kids. And he called me somewhere around September, October. He said, hey, Ridley, he said, the vice president, the one who had been at my side in Josh's room, as well as the chief lawyer for the hospital, going to be in town next week. Would you be willing to talk to him? I said, I don't know. I really don't want to. He said, well, I think it would be a good idea to bring closure to this. I said, well, I didn't say I wouldn't. I just said I don't want to. So we met in his office in downtown Nashville. And I didn't know it at this time, but it was the beginnings of the pieces of all this starting to fall into place. The two guys who came to meet with us were both Christ followers. And that day, what we had not been able to accomplish in Savannah in several hours of debate, we finished in about 30 minutes. We went to lunch together. We prayed with each other. And it was there that I first began to see that God was fixing to do something. The vice president handed me all the paperwork to sign. We finished signing the papers. He said, Mr. Barron, he said, I'm going to apologize in advance for what I'm about to ask you. I hope it does not offend you. He said, but we've been very pleased with the way you have responded to what was obviously a huge error on our part. He said, I was just wondering if you would be willing to come to Savannah, to the hospital, and speak to our employees and talk to them about what you've been through. They see statistics and hear numbers and charts and graphs all the time. He said, but they've never heard from the face of a victim of one of our errors. Would you be willing to do that? And I laughed at him. And he looked at me and said, did I say something funny? I said, well, you think this is your great idea, but God and I negotiated this back in my recliner in July down in Douglas, Georgia. He said, well, I'm not going to take God's credit. You just feel free to come if you're willing. So I did. 8 months after the accident in December, very foggy morning in Savannah, Georgia, I walked back into the hospital where my son was killed. Spoke to about 400 people, 450. Got through, and as I was walking out of the auditorium up the steps to the left, about halfway down the steps, I was met by a young blonde-headed lady with a pharmacist jacket on, big tears in her eyes. She stopped me. She said, my name is so-and-so, and I work in the pharmacy here, but I'm not the pharmacist. She's just a very, very good friend of mine, and I know she would have loved to have been here just to hear that you say you forgive her. And I said, she's not here. She's never heard that. She said, oh, no, not to my knowledge. She said she was fired after 26 years the day after it happened. And if she had heard those words from you, I'm sure she would have let me know. So my understanding is they've recorded this for training purposes. Would you make sure she gets a copy of it so she can hear it? She said, absolutely. 2 weeks later, I was back up in my house in Franklin, Tennessee, where I lived at the time, doing what single dads do best. I was warming up macaroni and cheese in the microwave for my kids for dinner. And the phone rang, and I picked it up and introduced myself. And the voice, a very timid voice at the other end of the line, said, my name is so-and-so, and I am the pharmacist. We had a good 15 to 20-minute conversation, and I apologized that it had taken 8 months for her to hear that I forgave her, and I even encouraged her to go back into pharmaceutical business. She said, no. She said, I am very happy with where I am in my life and the ability to be home with my kids and stuff like that after 26 years. She said, I just needed to hear from you that you forgive me so that I could go on my life. I said, absolutely. I said, I don't want you living 1 minute of regret because you did the right thing for my son. And you were trying to do the right thing the day that the error happened. And I just, my hope is that you will never look back with any regret, that you'll enjoy your time with your kids. 3 days later, Wayne Marchant, who was that vice president I've mentioned before, who now is a very, very good friend of mine, he called me on the phone. He said, listen, he said, we had such a great response for your time in Savannah. He said, I was just wondering if you'd be willing to do it again. And I said, well, sure. I thought he meant come back to Savannah and speak to those people. He said, well, good. I've got you booked for the National Association of Children's Hospitals in Boston next month, their national convention. I went, no. And he said, well, why not? I think he was prepared for that answer. He said, why not? I said, listen, Wayne, I'm not a medical expert. I don't have the education, don't have the background. If you want to talk theology or salvation or whatever with me as a pastor, I'll be glad to talk to you all day long, but this isn't my field. And he said, well, that's exactly why I want you, Ridley. He said, I feel like the pharmacies, the hospitals, the nurses, the doctors, for too long, they've heard the experts in our field. They need to hear from somebody on the other side of the bed. And so what began as a one-time trip to a hospital in Savannah to just talk a little bit has now turned into what I think is the greatest gimmick in the world. Because I tell people I am a patient safety consultant and quality of care person. But hospitals and insurance companies pay me to come into their hospital and tell them about Jesus and his grace and his forgiveness and the power of a God who can carry you through any difficulty. But I want you to hear something from me, and this is what this is really all about this morning. This isn't an easy journey and has not been. Don't let the story gloss it over by condensing it into a few minutes here. Forgiveness is an everyday choice. There have been days where I've wanted to find that driver. He was an illegal alien without a driver's license, with no insurance. He shouldn't even been driving at all. There have been days I've wanted to go find that guy and just beat the whatever out of him. That was the pastor coming out at me. I just wanted to go find him and take care of business. There were times I wanted to go sit down with that pharmacist and look her in the eye and say, do you realize what you took from me? Do you understand that? This journey's been very difficult for me because, as I said earlier, there were things that I uttered out of my mouth that I never thought I would ever question. Gosh, I was brought up in the nursery at a church. I was at vacation Bible school every year. I got saved at age 8. I knew all the answers. In fact, I was paid to give those answers to other people. But when pain hit my life, when tragedy struck me, I was on my own, I felt like, because none of those answers were good enough. The Sunday school went away, and it was time for real life because real life was coming. So I used to tell my church members all the time, I have discovered that on this planet, this side of heaven, you are either in the midst of trial, you're coming out of a trial, or you're getting ready to go into one. And the time to lean on this word is not when the trial comes. It's far before it ever gets to you. You better know it. You better understand it. You better comprehend it, because Sunday school's not good enough when real life happens. So as I was screaming out those questions, as I was having those debates with God, God began to put pieces together for me. It started with a little old lady in southeast Georgia about 2 weeks after the accident. Now, you have to understand, I lived in a town of about 25,000 people. I'd been there for 4 years. I knew a ton of those people, just being the person that I was and the kind of personality I have. I just didn't meet a whole lot of strangers. But 2 weeks after the accident, this sweet lady came up to me I'd never seen before and I haven't seen since, and I'm convinced was an angel who was beginning that process in me. And she walked up to me and she said two things. She said, I want to tell you, I know why your wife died and you're still here, which obviously got my interest. And I said, why is that? She said, because you weren't ready for heaven. I went, ooh, I don't know if I like that answer. And she said, because God's got something he's ready to do with you. And it's not your time yet. I thought, okay. And then the second thing that she shared with me was this passage, this obscure passage in the book of Joel, one of the minor prophets. Now, I've read the Bible through numerous times as a pastor. I've studied the book of Joel in classes at seminary and those kinds of things. So she pulls out this passage in Joel chapter 2, verse 25. I think it's going to be on the screen here for you. Joel 20, chapter 2, 25, it says, I will restore to you the years that the swarming locust has eaten, the hopper, the destroyer, and the cutter, my great army which I sent among you. And then verse 26, it says, you shall eat in plenty and be satisfied and praise the name of the Lord your God who has dealt wondrously with you. This lady comes up to me and she says, Joel chapter 2, verse 25, you go look it up. So I go back, I look up Joel chapter 2, verse 25, and it says, the Lord will restore the years the locusts have eaten. And I remember reading that and going, God, that's really fine and good, but I don't have a locust problem. I'm not a farmer. This means nothing to me. And it wasn't until years later that it started to come together. I kept searching the scriptures. I kept looking for things. I kept asking for help. I kept praying for answers. And then I kept questioning God over and over and over again. Then somewhere along the journey, I came across a passage in Psalm chapter 71. Psalm 71, it says in verse 19, "Your righteousness reaches to the skies, O God, you who have done great things. Who, O God, is like you?" Read that part and I thought, well, that's pretty cool. Yeah, that's right. You're the one. I get it. You created the heavens and the earth. What does that mean for me right now? You're the big guy. Verse 20, "Though you have made me see troubles many and bitter, you will restore my life again." And as I thought about that, and as I kept pondering that, and I kept putting it together in my heart, the thing that kept just jumping out at me was that trusting God was my only hope. He was the only thing that could make sense of all this for me. He's the only one who could bring all the pieces together. He was the only one that was going to get me back on my feet. I remember the Saturday that they brought Harrison and Abby into my room for me to tell them that their mother had died. And as they brought Harrison in, he was in a wheelchair. He's 9 years old at the time. His face is swollen because he's been crying so much. It's amazing how those images stick in your head. And I remember as they opened the door to bring him in, thinking to myself, I cannot afford to be bitter. I cannot afford to quit because he needs daddy. And his sister needs a daddy. And at that time, I thought Josh needed a daddy. I can't afford to quit. So those debates at night would get pretty passionate because inside there was this war going on. Do you quit or not? Do you keep going or not? Then a few years back, I came across the passage that I guess it really, really changed my life more than anything. The book of John. The funniest places. Because I had kept reading all the way through the suffering, all the way through the question. I had kept reading the Bible, reading the Bible, reading the Bible. John chapter 6, a very familiar story for most of us if we've grown up in church at all. It's where Jesus fed the 5,000 people on the hillside. And you get down to verse 12, and it says, "When they had all had enough to eat, he said to his disciples, 'Gather the pieces that are left over. Let nothing be wasted.'" Let nothing be wasted. That's my encouragement to you guys. You need to hear something, because what I heard out of that verse as I read it that day was, God will not let 1 minute of this be wasted. He will not let 1 minute of this journey go away without something being bought back, some reward for it, some exchange for it, something to be gained for it. Even if it's just one life, it'll be worth it. And slowly by slowly, as I kept trusting him, not overnight, not even in a week's time, I began to see God bring the pieces back together. And he put them together in a way I never could have. He opened doors that I couldn't believe. He introduced me to an amazing woman that I eventually married about 4 years ago. And just all these cool things started happening. And he started putting me in places. And as I said, I get to go into places today that just never would I have dreamed I'd been able to go to. But it's not about patient safety and quality of care, even though I carry that mantle. It's about being able to take the hope and the peace and the love and the healing and forgiveness of Jesus Christ into a world that doesn't know that it really exists. I remember 2 or 3 years ago, I was in Scottsdale, Arizona. And typically when I go into hospitals or conferences, I will do a conference and they'll say, "Hey, can we video this to teach doctors and nurses and stuff like that?" And I had gone into this hospital, and that particular day I was going to speak 3 times. And early that morning, the guy had come in that was doing the video for him. He said, "I'm here with the video department of our hospital. Can you put on this lapel so I can record you?" Very nice guy, very cooperative. Well, after the 3rd session that day, I was standing around, and as is the custom, there's usually people who want to talk to me who've gone through their own personal trials. And so they're standing there, and we're talking just a little bit. And I could see him standing out of the corner of my eye, standing over there just at a safe, respectable distance. And he was kind of wrapping up some cords and just very slow and intent with what he was doing. And finally finished his conversations with these people. And I thought, oh, he's probably waiting on the lapel mic. So I took it off and started wrapping it up and walked over towards him. And as I got up closer, I could see he had big tears in his eyes. I said, "Hey, man," I said, how is it? What's going on?" He said, "I just had to hang around and talk to you." He said, "You see, I do work for the video department. I wasn't supposed to video here today. The guy that was supposed to do the video work called me at the last minute. He was sick. He wanted to know if I could take his place." He said, "I left the house this morning with a suicide note on the table. I wasn't planning on going home." I have a wife and three kids, and the only reason I took this job was so I could put a little bit more money in their pocket before I left. He said, I got to know what it is that you have hope in. I need you to help me get into a church. I need you to help me find this peace that you're talking about. Just a couple months ago in Iowa, I had an event where I was speaking to this large hospital chain four times that day. And after the second session, a lady comes up to me with her husband, and she's got big tears in her eyes. She said, I got to tell you this. She said, you're not going to believe it. She said, first session this morning, one of my coworkers from my department was in your thing. I said, yeah. She said, she's a Wiccan, practices witchcraft, doesn't believe in God. As long as I have worked in this department, she will not talk to me because she knows that I'm a Christ follower and she refuses to have anything to do with me. I said, okay. She said she left your session this morning, came right back to the hospital, walked into our department with tears in her eyes and hugged my neck. She said, you've got to go hear this guy speak. See, God's put me in the path of people that I never, ever would have had if I continued to live my life the way I scripted it. In fact, I'd still be pastoring a little church in Southeast Georgia. I'd still have my sweet little white house down there with my dumb black dog that I had. And I'd be driving my little pickup truck, and I would be content with what I was. God had bigger plans. God had something else in store. If you asked me today, would you have chosen it? No. If I could go back and rewrite the script, would I rewrite it and do it differently the way he chose? No. I'd be a fool to do that. But in the midst of my trial, I hang on to that promise that God leaves nothing without reward, that none of the pieces are wasted. And that's my encouragement to you here today. I don't know where you are. I don't know what you're going through. I don't know what struggles you face or what struggles you will face coming down the road. I don't know if the doctor's report will come back in a bad way. I don't know if your husband or wife's going to want to walk out on you. I don't know if as a college student you don't have the finances to go chase your dream. I don't know what your struggle is, but I can tell you this. Your God is bigger than all of it. He is bigger than all of it. I'm going to put a picture up for you. And I put this picture up for two reasons. First of all, it's because I'm very proud of my family. You see, I'm a very blessed man. Standing right here, the second from the right, is my beautiful new wife of 4.5 years, Lisa. I joke all the time about the fact that I had this incredibly gorgeous, beautiful wife that I never thought I could love anyone as much as that. And God says, watch, I'm going to give you the privilege of loving two ladies, and you're going to get away with it. Next to her, the far right, is her oldest daughter, Morgan, and right in front of me is her daughter, Lennon. Two precious gifts. Guys, you need to understand something. My 17-month-old was taken from me, and in exchange, God gave me two beautiful daughters. And I don't mourn for Sarah and Josh. And you want to know why? Because they're where I want to be. I mourn for me because I'm stuck here. That's the problem. You see, my son's in a place where he'll never have to take a history test, he'll never have to wear braces, and he'll never have to ask a girl on a date. Why would we complain? That's where I want to be. That's my longing. That's what I'm doing. And so I'm constantly asking God, God, what do you got to do in me to make sure I'm ready to be there with them? On the far left is my son, Harrison. He's 17 years old now, drives a big red pickup truck, and that's why I have gray hairs. He was 9 at the time of the accident. It was his voice that woke me that day. In front of me, between Lisa and myself, is my daughter, Abby. She's 13, fixing to be 14 shortly. She was 6 the day of the accident. I'm going to take the time. Chris said I could go till 3:30 this afternoon, so I'm going to go ahead and do that. I'm going to take time to share this little story because it's a two-part story, but it's my favorite story of the whole event, and it kind of gives you an image of where we were as a family and what God can do. About 6 weeks after the accident, I had gone into Abby's room and tucked her in. We prayed together every night, so I prayed with her, and she asked me if I could lay down in the bed with her for a second, so I did. And as I got comfortable and laid down next to her, she said, Daddy, are you going to find us another mommy? I said, well, I don't know, baby. I said, it's kind of up to God. We'll just have to pray about it. She goes, well, why? I said, well, I mean, it's just one of those things you just have to pray about. You have to follow his will, and you have to make sure you're doing the right thing. She said, can you start tomorrow? I said, well, we can start praying tonight. I said, but you have to understand this isn't going to be an easy thing. She goes, well, why not, Dad? I said, well, because guys like your daddy aren't on the high demand list. I said, I have two children. I'm 36 years old, and I am a pastor of a church. That's just not what every woman's looking for. And she got really deep in thought. She goes, well, daddy, I'd marry you. I think you're very pretty. Which just goes to show the resiliency of children when they go through things like this. And I wasn't offended by the question because I understood it wasn't that she didn't miss her mother. In fact, it was because she missed her mother so much, she was wanting to get back to what she had always known, the security and stability of her mom and dad together. Fast forward a few years, Lisa and I have been married probably about a year at the time, or maybe even less. The cemetery that they are buried in is on the main road between Thompson Station and Franklin, where our church is. And so we go up and down it all the time and pass the cemetery. And one day, Lisa is driving Abby somewhere, I think to soccer practice, and she sees Abby glance over at the cemetery and just look away. And Lisa, being the great mom that she is, goes, Abby, you know it's okay. It's okay to talk about them. And Abby just burst into tears. So Lisa comes home and she said, you know, years ago when you took the kids to counseling the first time? I said, yeah. She said, you remember the counselor then said that if you wanted to, it would probably be a good idea the rest of their life to do checkups every now and then just to make sure they're still processing everything? Yeah, I said, yeah. She said, it's probably time for one of those checkups with Abby. So I took her to a Christian counselor, and the lady had only been in there with her for 15 minutes. She came out of the room, left Abby in there coloring a picture. She walked up to me, and she looked me in the eye. She said, I want to tell you what's going on with your daughter. I said, okay. She said, for the last 3.5 years of your life, she has been your wife in her mind. She has loved you. She has cared for you. She has taken the place of her mother to make sure you were going to be all right. And now that you're remarried, she doesn't know what to do with herself. She's just starting to grieve. There's a second reason why I put this picture up here, and it's being an encouragement to all of you. Because wherever you are and whatever you are going through right now in this moment in your life, I just want you to know there's always hope. Because when I look at this picture, Joel chapter 2, verse 25 begins to make sense. God will restore the years the locusts have eaten. And man, has he restored for me. Bless me in ways I never could have dreamed. I want to share one little story, and then I'm done. About 3 weeks after the accident, I was sitting in my office in Douglas where I was pastoring. On the corner of my desk were the pictures you saw a minute ago of the van that were taken for insurance purposes. A good friend of mine who owned a chemical company there in town, very intelligent guy, walks in. He picks up the pictures, and he starts to flip through them. He said, Ridley, how fast did they say the vehicles were going? I said, well, the Georgia Highway Patrol said that both vehicles were doing about 55 miles an hour when they made impact. He just kind of shook his head. I said, Gene, what are you thinking? I can see those wheels just a-turning in your head. What are you thinking? He said, do you realize that at that speed, 1/2 second sooner or later to this intersection, this wreck never happens and your family's alive and here with you tonight at church? 1/2 of a second. And that left such an impact on me that it's an impact I try to leave on you. It's an impact I try to leave on the healthcare professionals I speak in front of and the churches we work with and the marriage retreats that Lisa and I do. Because I want you to understand something. The rest of your life will be faced with half seconds where you will be faced with choices. And in those half seconds, the decisions you make can literally change you or someone else forever. There's a driver in Southeast Georgia who in 1/2 second tore my world apart because he missed a stop sign. There's a pharmacist in Savannah, Georgia who hammered me even harder when I was already down because in 1/2 second she chose to ignore the warnings and skip the double checks and sent up a medication that she should have never sent. And in the last 7.5 years, I have been faced with literally millions of 1/2 second choices where God said to me, what are you going to do with the pain? What are you going to do with the suffering? What are you going to do with the grief? I wish I could say in every 1/2 second I've gotten the answers right, but in most of them I have. And in those half seconds, I chose to give him to God and say, I believe that you are bigger than all of this. So I will trust you. May not make sense to me, but I will trust you. And the reason I share that story with you is because I want you to think about the half seconds in your life. In fact, the very next half second. Because I'm fixing to tell you something that in the next half second could change you forever, if it hasn't already. I wasn't the first person to suffer. You see, Jesus Christ did that for you. I could sit here and beat myself up and say, oh, woe is me. I have suffered unnecessarily. But guys, there's never been anybody but Jesus who suffered unnecessarily. And he did it for you. And because of that great love that sent him to the cross to die for you, you in the next half second can know peace and joy like you've never known it in your life, just like Dalton and Reagan. There may be some of you here who already know Christ Jesus, and I thank you for that. I'm so thankful that God has gotten a hold of your heart. But in the next half second, you may find the reassurance that you're looking for, that he's big enough for what you're facing. That verdict of cancer in your heart, that verdict of cancer in your lungs, that verdict of cancer that's just consuming your mind, in this next half second, you can trust to give it to God and believe that he will take care of you through this process. That note you received last week that seems like the end of your world, I promise you, it's not. The end of your world is found in God. And in the next half second, you can find everything you need to pick the next step in front of the other, to keep moving through this life. Every half second counts. What are you going to do with them? Will you pray with me? Father, I thank you for the opportunity just to talk about you this morning. There's no greater subject in the world. Lord, sometimes when we're in the midst of the very, very deep darkness, that just doesn't make sense. It seems like some kind of dream, some kind of fantasy that somebody up there could take care of us down here. But Lord, I pray that as I stand before these people today, I stand as a testimony of not how big and strong I am, but how big and strong you are. How powerful you are, how capable you are of carrying us in the darkest of moments. As I look over this room from one wall to the next, from front to back, Father, there's 100 different stories in this room going on right now. Some people are riding the crest of a high and they're at a sweet place in their life, and I'm just so thankful for that, and I just pray that right now is the time that they're digging even harder to find you. But in a crowd this size, I would be naive to believe that everybody's got it all together. There are some who are searching, some who are struggling, some who have questions that don't seem to have answers, Father. And I am here to stand before them and profess with your strength and your power and your might that every question has an answer in you. It may not be the answer we're looking for. It may not be the answer we would design for ourselves. It may not be the answer we wanted to hear. But I promise right now, Father, your answers can be enough if we just trust you in this next half second. So my prayer over these people, and even for myself, even in this moment, is that our hearts will be soft enough to hear what you have to say. Yes, God, you are big enough to hear our questions. You're big enough to hear us challenge you. But are we big enough to hear the answers you want to give us? In these next few seconds, I pray that we are.